Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of the Commercial Real Estate 101 Meetup Group. For those of you guys who are tuning in for the first time, we actually started this group back in April of 2020, kind of not necessarily in response to COVID, but during that period of time. And ever since then, we've just been inviting speakers every other week to talk about a variety of different topics pertaining to commercial real estate. And today I'm honored to have a good friend of mine who is a broker locally in the space and who's an all-star landlord rep, talk a little bit about the landlord rep process and explain a little bit about the nuance of that vertical of the commercial real estate brokerage space. So Charlotte, welcome. Always good to see you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on here. As you know, I'm really nervous. So don't judge me if I'm kind of weird or awkward. No. I promise you.
it's awesome. I mean, and I don't say this lightly. I really do respect you immensely in the space. And I believe you're one of the best landlord reps in the city. So I'm really looking forward to the insights you're going to share during the podcast. And so, you know, starting off, you know, I wouldn't say if I didn't mean it. But really, I think what it comes down to is what I think I was going to ask is, you know, typically when we first get started in the interview, we like to learn a little bit more about the person that's across the table from us. So if you don't mind kind of sharing, telling us a little bit about yourself, I think that'd be great.
Yeah. So my name is Charlotte Holkamp. I'm with Nexus Commercial Advisors. I've been practicing commercial real estate since 2012. I actually did co-found Nexus Commercial Advisors with my business partner, Mark Helm, in 2016. So almost about 7 years ago, we opened Nexus. I serve as the managing partner and a member of the commercial real estate brokerage team. I am considered more of a generalist in that I do office, retail, light industrial, self-storage, kind of do all of the different property types. I probably do more retail than I do office. And then I also, although this podcast is on landlord representation, I also do represent landlords, tenants, sellers, brokers, and those looking at 1031 exchanges.
Absolutely. No, that's a good clarification point because you're right. I mean, we do, and I'm kind of in the similar boat to you. I operate as a generalist as well. And, you know, I've just had a good portion of my business over the last couple of years be retail. And I know that's kind of where we have crossed paths most retail side. So, but definitely interested in learning a little bit more regarding really the landlord rep process. And the reason, you know, I like to do this in the podcast is we typically try to focus on a topic of discussion per interview. And the reason for that is because it just gives people an opportunity to refer to this at a later date if they want to kind of learn a little bit more about those individual verticals. And so today we focused our discussion on landlord rep, which I know you do a ton of. And so I kind of thought it would be important and probably just kind of clarifying if you could share what do you think or how would you, I guess, define what a landlord representative is?
So I think generally speaking, I think a landlord is somebody who understands the needs of the landlord and the pains that they've experienced with their properties and their portfolio, and we're someone that helps them understand the pros and cons of their property and recruiting a prospective tenant. We market the property and highlight all their properties in a way that's in line with their ultimate vision. And then we help them understand the true value of their property and try to maximize those returns and create a good working relationship for the landlord and the tenant alike.
Yeah, 100%. And it is very strategic when it comes to representing those landlords because, you know, you don't necessarily just want to accept any type of tenant that comes through the door. You know, you have to be very strategic about, you know, obviously given the particular space, what would be a great use for the space or, you know, how would you potentially, you know, leverage these different tenants on site to be able to maximize the ultimate value of the building, because that's ultimately your goal is to try to make sure that your seller is, or you're not necessarily even seller, the owner of that property is getting maximal return on whatever investment they have in the property. So,
And that's where I think, even though you're technically just a landlord representation, we are dual agents a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps you understand when you're a landlord representation or a rep, when you're also a tenant rep, because it helps you get an insight into both perspectives too, which I think is always helpful, at least for me personally.
Absolutely. And just to clarify, for those of you guys who are listening outside of Kentucky, you know, dual agency in Kentucky is illegal. I know in some other states that may not be the case, but dual agency obviously is where you represent both the tenant and the landlord in the same transaction. And there's obviously disclosures that need to take place and you've got to operate in a certain way to ensure that, you know, everything is you're operating in that proper manner. But you're right. It's a not an uncommon thing to have that happen when you are a landlord representative, where you have tenants that are unrepresented that approach you. And obviously you're able to kind of navigate those waters in that setting. Now, as far as the process goes, you know, typically with a landlord rep, you are going to be evaluating opportunities for landlord representation. So I guess my question really is, you know, when evaluating a listing opportunity, what are some of the things you look for? And really, you know, what questions do you ask the owner to kind of get more clarity on what you're going to be dealing with?
Yeah. So first foremost, I try to understand the history of the landlord and the property itself. I even have a checklist. I have different items I go through, little cheat sheets to help me understand the strengths and the weaknesses of both the landlord and the property alike, which might sound strange, but when I say assess the landlord's strength and weaknesses, it's maybe such as the landlord's current financial position. Is it more of a local mom and pop owner that may not have access to tenant improvement allowances, that have a tighter budget, or are you dealing with a REIT or a national accredited investor who might have access to those funds? And that does change, I think, the prospecting process. If you also try to figure out if they prefer more local regional tenants versus national. Most of the time you're going to say national, but when you are dealing with national tenants, that does mean that additional considerations are usually taken into account, such as the TI allowance, landlord's work, more free rent. So you kind of have those conversations with the landlord on the front end. And then you try to figure out, like, is the landlord willing to subdivide the space? Try to figure out the characteristics of each property. And then you try to figure out, like I said, what the landlord's goals are and how those align with the prospective tenant's needs. And you try to figure out, like, their most important deal points. So I'll try to get them to rank it. Obviously, they're going to want the best across the board, but I try to say, like, what's most important if you had to choose? The highest base rent, the shortest free rent period, little to no TI, is it an as-is deal? Do you want at least tomorrow, which everybody's going to say yes, or would you rather sit on the market and wait for the ideal tenant? It really varies. Like I said, traditionally, you're going to say, we want at least tomorrow, we want the highest paying rent, no TI, as is. Sometimes that's not always possible. So we try to understand that so that we can meet their needs. And like I said, once we get an understanding of that, we try to make sure we're both on the same page, because then we convey that to them. And from the beginning, I really try to set realistic expectations for the landlord in order to meet or exceed them. I never want to overcommit and underdeliver, which I have seen. And a lot of times that ends up with a bad relationship, I think, moving forward, when you tell them, okay, we can get you $5 higher than what market is just to get the listing. That's not going to work in anybody's favor, because they're going to be disappointed. So I usually say, here's kind of where I think we market it at. And depending on what their conversations were, do we price it in line, give ourselves wiggle room for those concessions?
Yeah, no, and that's a phenomenal point you made, because like you said, a lot of times what ends up happening is people don't set proper expectations on the front end, and then everyone ends up not being happy with what transpired. And
yeah,
understanding the marketplace and the client themselves about what their most important goals are, and understanding, like, there's certain situations where you can have your cake and eat it too, but then there's other situations where it's like you got to make some concessions in certain regards if you're trying to really maximize the value of that asset. So I appreciate the context there. And I'm assuming, as you mentioned before, you have kind of a checklist of things that you've learned over time, and you have it's a repeatable process. And we talk about a lot on this podcast, documentation. So you shouldn't have to reinvent the wheel every single time. You know, as you learn through the business, you should be documenting all these different questions. You should be making sure that you follow a particular process, so it just becomes repeatable every single time that you take on a new listing. And so obviously,
like I said, I have my little checklist that goes through all the general terms, questions I might forget to ask. And then I'll create what I call my little cheat sheet. So when people call, I can grab it out and be able to answer their questions effectively, which that's, we'll get into that, but that's actually a very important aspect of it too. But it kind of just summarizes everything, and you develop that relationship early on.
Yeah, 100%. And obviously there's so many factors that go into play when we're talking about that, which I know we'll kind of dive into a little bit further in this discussion. So, you know, let's say that you've done the checklist. So you've approached the landlord, you all have come into agreement and set expectations properly about what's to be done. You've kind of laid out the space and understand what you're working with as far as the space requirements is concerned. And now you're trying to work on identifying potential tenants for the space. So I guess, what are some of the strategies that you use to identify the right tenant for a particular space? And obviously there's a lot of factors at play. So I figured I'd kind of ask you that.
Yeah. So first and foremost, we use that information from the initial listing appointment to make sure our tactics are in line, because that's where you kind of tailor it a little bit. Almost think of like a flow chart where, okay, if this one's here, then we're going to go here. And you kind of follow that flow chart. And then you combine that and also evaluate, for example, the zoning regulations, if it's a part of a local municipality or maybe like a larger one such as Metro Louisville. So you figure out what your zoning regulations are, what you can and cannot do from a zoning perspective. And then I research deed restrictions, prohibited and exclusive uses for the complex that individuals may have or as an overall development may be in place. I then look at I assess the current tenant mix for the shopping center and the direction that we see the center going. Maybe they want to make it more of a lifestyle center, entertainment, more food. I look at that tenant mix of now and proposed. And I also compare that to the surrounding tenant mix. Like, if you're surrounded by a ton of competitors, that can or cannot be a good thing. You just kind of have to look at what the market demands. And you also factor in the demographics for the site. And then you've looked to see like what side of the road's on. I know that's a weird conversation, but if we're talking about retail, that's going to determine if it's a breakfast user or a dinner user, because people don't like to take left turns into a development, especially when they're running late for work. So you kind of take into account all those small factors that when you first get into the business, you might not really realize how important those are, but they are very important. So you kind of overlay that. You assess the parking situation. So a lot of times you might have a high consumption parking user, such as a gym or like a call center. You have to evaluate what the parking needs are as well as what the limitations may be. And you need to factor that in together. Then you look at unique characteristics of each space, like what is the width? What is the depth? What is the ceiling height? How many points of ingress and egress are there? Like front door, is it a double door or is the back a double door in order to get deliveries? Can they get semis through? Where are the trash dumpsters located? Is it a second generation restaurant space or second generation medical? Because those are costly build outs. So that will, a lot of times you'll try to seek a tenant for those second generation space that are more expensive build out. You look to see if there's a drive-through potential. Same thing with outdoor seating. Things, like I said, very unique about the space. You try to leverage so you can minimize the concessions that would have to take place for both the landlord and the tenant alike. You can shorten that if you find somebody that can easily go into the space. Obviously, it doesn't always work out. Sometimes it's complete conversions, but we try our best. And then also, I rely very heavily on open dialogue with other brokers, such as yourself. We do this frequently. I'll schedule calls with brokers in our market who represent various tenants. And we'll discuss what their needs are, whether it's for my property or another one. And it could be a lead for now or for later on, but you kind of, that brainstorming process helps you think through, they may be a good tenant or maybe one of their competitors who's also in market. Like those uses, it kind of gets your brain flowing. And then I'll also go through, I keep a detailed log of everybody that calls on my properties that we have listed. I try to review the call log in my notes to see if there's other users that maybe the property that they called on didn't work for them, but this could be a good fit, or needs have changed, or I see a lot, I'm getting a lot of medical calls, or I'm getting a lot of staffing company calls for similar properties. Then I may try to focus on those by leveraging other relationships in.
Yeah, and that's a great idea. That's another idea that I didn't even think of, is that if you're getting a call from certain users because of the unique characteristics of that space, maybe that's a good indication of the type of user you should be, you know, actively outreaching to. But I also really do appreciate the insights you shared regarding, you know, obviously the more nitty gritty side, which is the understanding the zoning, because that's going to be a big driver for what can actually be on site if you don't have proper zoning. We face that a lot in different scenarios with tenants trying to find a space. It looks perfect, but then the zoning's not right. And unless you're willing to go through the whole the whole process.
Expensive and time consuming.
Yeah. Oftentimes it's not worth it. And, you know, and again, the parking side of things too is huge. I know with some centers, parking's never an issue, but then there's other centers where, you know, they have a very, they'll have some parking hogs on site, which could cause issues as far as what designated parking you could potentially get and that sort of thing. So,
and you also have, for example, like if it's more of a medical, they need to have parking spaces directly in front of the door because their clients can't go very far. It's weird how much you would think, you don't realize how much parking comes into play, but that usually is a very important aspect.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you stress the importance too, which I've kind of reiterated on this podcast over and over, is building relationships with different brokers. Because, you know, in most markets, I would imagine, and obviously I can comment on Louisville versus others, but, you know, you kind of run into the same people over and over and over again. So it's not like a lot of times in residential real estate where you may do a transaction with an agent once every blue moon. I mean, I feel like in the retail space, there's like a handful of us that are transacting at a relatively high level. So it's like, okay, there's a probability that they either have something that one of my tenants wants, or maybe I'm representing a landlord and the other person may have a tenant that we could have, could be a good fit for this particular space. So building those long-term relationships with tenant reps and really just other brokers in your market is invaluable. So I appreciate the insight.
Yeah. There's sometimes deals transact offline. So this space might be becoming available. So if I didn't know about your client's need and this tenant's lease is coming up, we can tell you about that in advance, even though the timing, it may not be publicly listed because we're not advertising it yet. We can say, hey, in the next 6 months, it looks like this is coming available if it's still available or they're still looking, for example.
Yeah, 100%. And I did two deals last year where they weren't even marketed. It just, I called up the person representing the center. I said, hey, like, you know, I got a tenant, this is the use and it's an attractive use. And what, do you have anything coming available? And he's like, yeah, we have XYZ coming available in 2 months or 3 months. And then it just kind of creates that dialogue. And it doesn't always pan out, you know, but again, there's a lot of times where you can leverage those different relationships to be able to get your tenants in places that otherwise they wouldn't have known about. So
exactly.
I think it's very valuable information. So, you know, I guess one of the things that, you know, once you have the process of identifying a few tenants, now you start the process of outreaching to kind of develop, you know, obviously you put it on these different platforms. Obviously we leverage Crexy, LoopNet, whatever other platforms you have. And then now you begin the process of general outreach for targeted types of uses to see if they could fit in those spaces. Once you do identify a potential tenant that has some interest, you know, what are some of the things that landlords look for when evaluating kind of a prospective tenant?
So this is going to vary landlord by landlord and deal by deal. But if generally speaking, what I see, this is in particular for the retail, is mainly what I've been speaking about on this, because office is more, a little bit more of an emotional based decision, where retail is more of a technicality. That's more of what I'm speaking to that on this podcast. But generally speaking, the landlord is going to request certain financial statements from the tenant, both from a business standpoint and their corporate financials, as well as an individual, depending on the strength of the tenant. So if there's a startup, they're going to look very heavily at the individual financials. If you're dealing with a national credit tenant, they're going to look more at the corporate. But that comes into play on determining whether a personal guarantee is required, which, like I said, barring your very large national users, a lot of times that is necessary. And then they will use that information to determine also how you are funding the build out and all of your equipment. They'll try to determine whether you have the capital to survive the first few months to a year, because that is usually a very tough time for the tenant. So they want to make sure you're successful and have that well thought through. They also need to make sure that any monetary concessions that they are extending to the tenant, that the tenant is able to pay that back, whether that be tenant improvement allowance or the landlord's doing work on behalf of the tenant. They want to make sure that they have at least have enough financials to support that if something were to go wrong, and determine if they maybe need to increase the security deposit. They also will likely, depending on what type of space it is, they may ask for a business plan to make sure that, if depending on if it's more of a startup, to make sure that the business is well thought through and that this is in line, because they want this to be it's a mutual relationship. They want you to succeed as much as yourself. And then they're going to ask you your business experience. So just make sure you're not completely switching industries without any understanding. They may ask those questions. And then, like I said, then they're just going to take those statements, and then they're also going to take into account the current tenant mix, like we talked about, making sure it's in line with what they're looking to do with the center, the parking needs and requirements that we talked about, your zoning, and then also individual characteristics of each. So whether it's odor producing, sound producing, or like cleanliness, they might factor that in too when they're thinking about security deposits. And then they're going to also look at how you're building out the space. So when you surrender the premises, is it going to be hard to relet? And that may determine on how you're required to surrender the space at the end of your lease term, whether you have to bring it back to the condition that it's delivered in or not.
Yeah. I mean, then those are some great points. You know, and oftentimes, you know, when you're representing tenants, for example, you know, trying to get a lot of this information on the front end to make everyone's life easier is obviously of benefit. So, you know, oftentimes when I start working with the tenant, I'll you know, kind of set expectations up front saying, look, like, we're going to need you to have your personal, like, especially if it's a, you know, not necessarily a corporate entity that is, you know, that obviously has gone through this process many times. And it's just kind of a, you know, kind of they do it as they sleep, as they say. But when it comes to someone who's a little bit more mom and pop or maybe regional, sometimes just setting those expectations on the front end saying we need the financials ready to go. We need, you know, any other relevant information that would be beneficial for the landlord to review to be ready so that we can kind of execute the process quickly, because I'm sure you've dealt in the past with people that don't necessarily have that ready to go. And it just takes a lot longer to really determine whether or not it's a good fit from a tenant standpoint. So
yeah, and they'll usually try to request it more on the front end because you can negotiate a deal, but then once they get the financials, they can drastically change the lease terms.
100%.
So I've seen it more and more requesting that on the front end
yeah,
for that reason.
And that's smart, because otherwise you'd be the landlord would be spinning their wheels, right? It's just like, okay, well, we could all in theory think it's a good thing. And then all of a sudden, once you start seeing all the nitty gritty financials and maybe some other factors that you didn't know on face value, then obviously it could potentially change the entire deal for everyone involved. So I think it's a wise decision. And obviously, kind of referring back to what we said before, having these documented processes, and I'm sure a lot of sophisticated landlords have these checklists. They're like, hey, we need this, because we're already used to this whole process. And it just helps us follow a regimented process so we can streamline who we can get in on site. Again, just kind of reiterating the documentation process is an important piece of the puzzle. All right. So one of the other questions I had was, okay, so now we've identified a tenant, they provided all the different, you know, financials, and we've done some checking regarding use and, you know, confirming that, you know, their particular use could be appropriate for whatever the space is. Now it comes time to get into the nitty gritty of negotiation. So I guess, what are some of the things that you've done from the landlord rep side? And just to clarify, because you're a landlord rep, obviously your best interests are, you're looking at the landlord side, you know?
Yes.
So
we have a legal fiduciary duty to the client.
Exactly. So what applies to landlord rep may not apply to a tenant rep. So maybe you can reapply it in the opposite direction. But again, your job as a landlord rep is to maximize the value for your client, which is the owner. So, you know, I wanted to kind of clarify that as a discussion point. So what kind of tactics, you know, or strategies do you use to help maximize the value or results for your landlord clients?
Okay. So first off, as we've talked about very detailed, is the number one thing is managing the landlord expectations, because this is where it really comes into play at this point, is once you're in a negotiation process. Mm-hmm. Not everyone likes the approach that I take. For me, I found it to be very successful, but I try to take more of the open, transparent, ongoing approach to leasing. So I have that communication with the leasing agent and the tenant up front. That way we ensure that there's a good long-term working relationship between the two. A lot of times, if you're coming in very aggressive on both ends, there's some animosity there that ultimately the tenant and the landlord have to have a good relationship. So if you kind of, I think, take up a more dialogue, transparent approach to it, both parties seem to be happier. And then both parties are more likely to come to the table to discuss what they need. And so I'll usually lay out, these are non-starters for the landlord. And usually the tenant or the tenant's leasing agent will disclose, like, these are non-starters. And then you try to work through the other points and best way to fit that puzzle together. Mm-hmm. And when you have that open relationship, then the defenses are up and you're usually able to get more information to figure out, okay, they want this, I want this, let's leverage these items in order to get the best deal forward, moving forward. Like I said, it doesn't always happen that way. There's some people that like to take the more aggressive approach, which we can do and we've done before, but generally speaking, the most successful transactions that I've been involved in thus far have been a byproduct of those type of relationships.
That's great. No, I'm of the same mindset as you. Is just, if you're transparent on the front end, there's no surprises, because if you are kind of holding everything close to the vest and then you get through your due diligence and you start realizing one thing versus another, you start questioning the whole process. And then that's when people get on edge and it can potentially cause a deal to fall through. And on the aggressive approach, I'm personally not of that mindset, because like you said, I mean, you're going to be running into people all the time. And so if you kind of, you know, take a brute force approach to things, that may benefit you for this particular instance, but over a longer period of time, it's not necessarily the best way to handle it. So
like I said, and from not even from us as agents, but like I said, the tenants themselves, because if they think that they were taking advantage of it in this extent, they're going to have a very like butting heads relationship long term, and there's not that level of trust between the two, where it takes a long time to develop when there is that very aggressive approach taken.
Yeah, and that's a great point. Like, you know, if one party thinks they've gotten taken advantage of versus the other, you know, how does that bode well for the relationship going forward? And when you're talking about leasing relationships, these are long-term deals. I mean, you know, it's
you're not talking about a buyer-seller, one transaction, they're done, they never see each other again. It is a different.
Yeah, it could be anywhere from 3 to sometimes even 20 years that you're going to be on site. So it's one of those things where, you know, it's better to cordially go through the process, and ultimately you want to have the best deal possible for yourself, but understand that there's different ways to approach the process than there is to just whip out a billy club and try to get what you think you deserve, right?
That's to be fair, they usually end up with the same terms anyways.
Yeah.
it just might be, actually I've seen them kind of work like not in each other's favors. They would be like, I don't really care about this one, but this one I felt the need to double down on just because.
It's when egos, it happens when egos get into play, and I understand. I mean, obviously egos are at play in every single transaction. So, you know, I think there's certain times where that bodes well or can serve you well. And there's other times where it's probably not a good thing. So just being able to determine when it's appropriate to do it is obviously something that you.
Yeah. I mean, there's usually, it comes down to 1 to 3 terms at the end that you're really trying to work through that the tenant doesn't want, the landlord doesn't work. So it's just, you do your best to get creative and try to get it through at that point.
Absolutely. So one of my questions are, obviously we've kind of walked through the process of landlord representation up until this point. We obviously negotiated the deal and now hopefully everyone is happy and the lease deal is consummated. And now that, you know, they all go out in the sun or off in the sunset, as they say, but as far as just kind of the nuances that we've discussed, you know, are there any resources in particular that you've kind of referenced over time to learn about landlord representation, or is it just kind of been just trial and error and trying to?
A lot more probably trial and error, but the number one thing is finding a good mentor in any industry type, whether you're in commercial real estate or not. It's very imperative to find a good mentor who you trust, who can walk you through your questions. Also relying on other brokers. We don't work at the same firm. Sometimes we work on opposite sides of the transaction, but working together on like, this is where the deal went wrong, this is where it went right, whether it's a deal that we did or just sharing experiences, that's going to be the best resource ultimately to understand landlord representation. I also, there's several industries, organizations. I really like CCIM, the organization. I think that is very helpful. Here locally, we also have CRE, the Kentucky Real Estate Exchangers. I attended, they meet twice a month and they kind of do deals and they brainstorm with each other. I found that very helpful. And I think that's where probably my relationship, helped leverage my relationships with other brokers with that. But formal education, definitely CCIM as far as the networking there too. Also understanding tenant representation, not just landlord representation materials, because you have to understand how the tenant thinks in order to understand how the two work together. So not just looking solely at landlord representation materials. Also, the hands-on experience, like read every LOI thoroughly, read every lease, look at every attorney's comments, and try to understand the ramifications of each deal term, how it plays into the overall deals. Because you may think, oh, that doesn't matter. But that actually could be a very big deal. So I think it's the more you read, kind of understand, although we are not attorneys, we can't practice law, you understand the negotiation overall terms, what you're trying to negotiate because of that. And then as far as books, I don't have any like great exactly books that are landlord rough. I have books that I like personally, but I don't know if they're necessarily landlord representation materials.
No, and I don't know if there are that many books that talk about this topic. So maybe that's a book you need to write.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it.
I'll give you that one. You're way better at writing. It gives me anxiety. Anxiety than doing this podcast.
I think you'd do great. I think you would. It's a process to write, but it's worth kind of, you know, putting everything, crystallizing everything into some form of readable format. It's always helpful. But
yeah.
But I agree. I mean, you know, I really appreciate the insight you shared about understanding the tenant side, because again, as a landlord rep, you have to attract these types of tenants to the site. And it's not a foregone conclusion that one tenant is going to have the same requirements or desires as another tenant is concerned. And so understanding some of those nuances is extremely important. And I highly agree with what you said regarding the legal side of things. And obviously we're not practicing attorneys, but
yeah,
in the brokerage business, especially in commercial real estate, it is very legal heavy in understanding, you know, the ramifications and implications of whatever transaction you're involved in. And so I can't tell you how many times I've talked to an attorney that's representing either my tenant or maybe I'm representing the landlord. I'm talking to the landlord attorney, and I'm just like picking their brain about, okay, what are some of the
don't be afraid to ask questions. Like, it's going to help in the long term, and they have a duty to represent their clients. So explain it to you, especially if it's an ongoing relationship, you know how what's very important to negotiate as a tenant moving forward. And same thing with the landlord, that these are terms that have to go in. And I that's one part of my checklist. I usually try to get a copy of the lease, their standard lease, very early on, so I can read it to see if there's any terms that may stand out that I need to negotiate on the front end closer to the LOI stage, that or letter of intent with LOI. Sorry, I don't know if I clarified that. Whether I clarify that at the letter of intent stage, whether this is going to be a very strong concession or not, or it's something to address in the lease by looking at.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And kind of piggybacking off this question regarding resources, are there any tools that you use currently that help kind of maximize the exposure of the listings that you have, like technology-wise? It's always good to kind of provide an additional.
Yeah. So the listing platforms we use here locally in Kentucky, KCREA, which is a division of the Commercial Exchange, which is a much broader network. That is the one that we locally rely the heaviest on, and I personally like the best. We also use Crexy. I use that basic account most of the time, just got a little pricey, so we use that some. Then I also use Buildout, which every one of our websites gets its own individual mini website, which syndicates, and it will have all of the floor plan, all of your standard information. It will have your brochure, it will have demographic reports, probably anything you can think of, an overkill on there. I try to do that, so it's one place to find everything. Site to Do Business is Esri is the entity that we use for a lot of our demographic reports that we get through our CCIM membership. I also use floorplanner.com. And I create 2D, 3D interactive floor plans for each of our spaces. Your national tenants, like I said, once again, they know what's going to work for them. They may not need this. They can just use the CAD drawings, but the average local regional tenant does not have access to CAD or really know what they're doing. So they may over-exaggerate or under-exaggerate their requirements. So you can do a rough conceptual plan and then give that to an architect and space planner to help finalize. But it usually helps with early on in the process because it helps the tenant understand what may need to be done to the space and what maybe doesn't need to be done to it. So we do use floorplanner.com at our brokerage. And then I really like Site to Do Business because I'm really nerdy. You can compare all the reports and drive times from that.
And it's a big deal, as you alluded to. So you know those type of things are important when you're analyzing a space because the type of user that may be work best in that space, based on the demographics, is probably going to be different than some other user. And so it is very important. We started using our brokerage Placer AI, which kind of similar to what
great things.
It's phenomenal. I would encourage you. I'll generate some reports for you in the Forum Center, the
one
we're working with. So we'll have to figure that. But it's great. It's really
compare the two. Yeah,
it's really good information. It's all based on like geofencing. So you could place like the markers around the property, and then over time it'll track the cell phone data of people that are coming on site. So it should provide somewhat of more of an accurate representation.
Oh, I would imagine so.
Clientele that come on site, and obviously there's a lot of information that you can generate from these phone records. You can pull age,
and
graphics, and
everybody's on these phones. Everybody's on their phones all the time. Absolutely. So,
and the amount of there's a lot of information that's out there about you is pretty shocking. So it just is what it is.
There was one I always use example. Like I can tell you how many people in a 1 mile radius. 5 minute drive time, whatever you determine as your radius, take B12 vitamins. It's not one thing that you thought people were going to monitor, but we do.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Yeah. Medical expenses per, capita. Mm-hmm. And then that's another thing when you learn in CCIM, you can start using some of that data to start determining what the potential need for a particular user could be on site. And so it creates this, powerful strategy, which on the landlord rep side, it's phenomenal because you could say, hey, look, here's all the data that we have regarding medical expenditures. These are the amount of tenants that are potentially nearby that could be potential competition, but there's still a vacuum of this particular user that could potentially be great. And obviously on the tenant side, that's kind of what you're trying to do. It's about creating the story, and hopefully you utilize numbers and data to kind of support whatever your
numbers, data, access points. Yeah. All those considerations.
Absolutely. So one of the questions that I was wanting to ask you kind of at the beginning, but we decided to kind of loop it back at the end was, we have a lot of people that listen to this podcast that are of early on in their career, either they first started or they're a year or two in, or maybe they're a little bit more established, but maybe they're 4, 5, 6 years in and they're still trying to build their clientele list and, just people that they can, work with on a regular basis. And so I guess one of the questions I have is, obviously you represent several different centers, both that have owners that are maybe local, but then there's also ones that you represent that are in the REITs or larger entities. So how did you kind of get to a point where you, kind of was able to build out that client list of yours?
Honestly, that's a question I get asked most by anybody looking to get into the industry or early on. I wish I had a little bit more detailed approach to give you, but for me, I was very fortunate. I had a mentor, Mark Helm, who had been in commercial real estate since the early 80s when I got into the industry in 2012. So early on, I did rely very heavily on his contacts, I'll be honest. But as time went on, I became more confident with myself and became more skilled in the industry as the experience. And then I expanded that to then tenant reps. The tenants then exposed me to additional landlords. It just kind of got me in the door. I attended networking events and met landlords may not even realize who I was speaking to. Just kind of asking about services, just talking through the market. It just kind of snowballed, to be fair, and into a bigger list. Sometimes you don't realize how you got there. Single biggest piece of advice I can give you is answer your phone, at least in our market. I have gotten several listings just by answering my phone. So whenever possible, answer it or call them back as soon as you're able to. I've had it also where landlords have pretended to be prospective tenants. I've had it on several occasions, and they'll figure out how I convey the information to prospective tenants. They'll see how I show the property, and they'll evaluate the follow up. And I have done some of my bigger accounts that way, was just unknowing that they were actually landlords looking for representation services rather than prospective tenants.
Like secret shoppers almost.
Exactly. Yeah. I've had that happen more than you think. And some of them liked actually when I was early in my career, because you'd be willing to go that extra mile. I'll show up to a random place of business and be like, hey, I wasn't sure if the owner would want this. And don't be scared to go out there. Don't be afraid to cold call or cold walk in. Don't be afraid of no. The only thing worse than no is to not ask at all. So, and then start small, take the small listings. A lot of times they'll turn into these bigger listings. So you're never too good for the small properties that you're asked, as long as you have enough time to properly serve the property and your client. Take the smaller listings. You don't know what those are going to turn into. And like I said, and also don't overpromise, rather overdeliver.
Yeah. And that could be, you know, tough early because you don't know what you don't know. So, I figure, but you're 100% right in that, you know, take every opportunity you have and just not try to knock it out of the park. And, you know, as long as you're putting forth a good effort over time, people will notice that. And you're going to become more knowledgeable as a result of you working in the business anyways. So, you know, you're not the same person you were when you started in 2012 than you are today. Like, it's not even, it's a 9-day difference. So it's one of those things, understanding the long game and, you know, just continuing to strive to improve every day. And that's all you can really hope for.
It sounds corny.
Yeah.
My parents are residential investors. Had no clue what I was getting into when I got into commercial real estate, but they always told me, we made our house out of bricks, not sticks. It's a long-term play, but the foundation is much stronger. And I know, like I said, that might sound goofy, but it's a long-term play on how you build it to have a more successful foundation and career, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's amazing. Well, I appreciate the feedback on that. That's awesome. So what we're going to go ahead and do is I was going to give us another, you know, couple minutes to kind of take questions from those who are watching live. If you guys are watching this, please go ahead and type away in the chat box. And we'll kind of go from there. But in the meantime, I guess one of the questions maybe I had that was not included was, do you have any other pieces of advice or maybe questions you wish I would have asked you that, you know, maybe wasn't something we kind of went over?
I looked at this right beforehand. I was like trying to scramble and see. Mm-hmm. I can't think anything at the moment, but like I said, if you have any questions, I'll be open book for you.
Oh, absolutely. No. We'll just go ahead and monitor the chat rooms real quick, and then we'll probably wrap up if there's no additional dialogue. But
awesome.
Let's see what we got. All right.
Maybe we got all of them.
I think we got all of them. So, well, Charlotte, you know, obviously, I greatly appreciate you stopping by. I think this was one of the better episodes we've ever had regarding the content that we shared, because, you know, I know that you're very meticulous and very data-driven individual. And so I knew you'd come prepared for this podcast, and I really do appreciate it. I really do appreciate the insights you shared. So if people wanted to learn more about you and maybe, you know, get in touch with you in some capacity, whether they're, you know, either brokers kind of seeking advice, or maybe they're potential landlords or tenants that are wanting to seek out your services, what's the best way to be able to get in touch?
So obviously I know this is going live on LinkedIn, so you can always find me on LinkedIn. That's going to be easy one. I think the easiest way is, once again, pick up your cell phone, give me a call. My cell phone number is 502-724-7325, and I will do my best to pick up as quickly as I can or return your call. And then we can go from there. You can also text that number if you have any questions, and we can discuss further.
That's great. And I will go ahead and include that in the show notes. So if you guys are watching this on YouTube, go ahead in the description and you'll see contact information for Charlotte as well as her email. I'll go ahead and make sure we include that in the show notes. And if you guys are listening to this in a podcast format, it'll be in the description as well. So again, Charlotte, thanks so much for stopping by. It was really a good discussion.
Thank you.
Oh, of course. And for those of you guys who are listening to this and you guys like this channel and this podcast, please like and subscribe. It does make a huge impact on our ability to reach a broader audience. Along with that, if you guys are interested in being part of the show and listening to the show, come back, come and engage. We do this every other week where we invite commercial real estate speakers from across the country and really the world to talk a little bit about commercial real estate. So thanks again so much for stopping by, and we'll see you all next time.
Thank you.